You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Scott Lamar. It didn't take long for the new Omicron variant of the COVID-19 coronavirus to show up in the United States. Just a week after most of us heard of the variant, the first Omicron was detected yesterday in California. It wasn't a surprise that it moved so quickly. It's still too soon to know how transmissible it is or if Omicron can cause serious illness. What we do know is that even without Omicron, COVID cases in Pennsylvania are high. The State Department of Health reported more than 7,600 new cases Tuesday. And 22 months into this ever-changing pandemic, many of us still have questions. During that time, Dr. John Goldman, an infectious disease specialist at UPMC in central Pennsylvania, has appeared on the program to answer questions and provide the latest information on the virus. He's here today to do just that. Dr. Goldman, always good talking with you. Okay, so I'll ask this question because even though I know you can't probably give a definitive answer, what do we know about Omicron and what don't we know?
I would say we don't know more than we do know. So what we do know is that Omicron has many more mutations than either the Alpha or Delta variant. So we know it has the potential to be more transmissible. We know it has the potential to cause more disease. And we know it has the potential to evade the vaccines. What we don't know is if any of that actually occurs outside of the test tube, if any of that actually occurs outside of people. So, for example, we know that it appeared in South Africa. We know that the cases in South Africa started to go up after it appeared. And we know that that it in South Africa caused relatively mild disease, probably because most of the people who got it in South Africa were young people who tend to have mild disease to begin with. So far, we don't know whether it is more, less, or just as transmissible as Delta. So far, we don't know whether it is more or less, causes more or less severe disease, and we don't know if it has the ability to evade the vaccine. I personally think that what will determine whether or not we see widespread infection with Omicron will be whether it is more contagious than the Delta variant. And we have to remember that the Delta variant right now is 99.9% of the variants in the United States. And in fact, the Delta variant has outcompeted every other variant easily. And so if Omicron is more contagious than the Delta variant, we are likely to see more of it because it is likely to outcompete the Delta variant. But if it's less contagious than the Delta variant is likely to outcompete it. And we are not likely to see much of it here. One of the only good things about the Delta variant is it has crowded out every other variant, including a couple of variants that at least have the potential to evade the vaccine or evade antibodies. And unfortunately, we just simply don't know how contagious Omicron is and whether it's more or less contagious than Delta. That determines whether we're likely to see it here.
You said outperforming other variants. You mentioned Alpha, Beta, and of course Delta is, and, you know, it's all Greek alphabet getting names. But other variants out there, have there been other variants? And why is it that we've heard so much about Omicron? And this, is it because it is so much different than the other variants?
So there are other variants. So for example, the original, when we had last winter, as we had a big peak in COVID, we began vaccinating people and the cases markedly declined. We then saw the Alpha variant, which is a variant from England, which is about 50% more contagious than the original variant. And that caused a peak in the United States and in central Pennsylvania. The cases began to decline and then the Delta variant came through. And the Delta variant just simply outcompeted, meaning it spread itself more easily than any other variant. And as a result, over a relatively short period of time, became the predominant variant in the United States. The CDC's last survey said it was 99.9% of the variants. And there were definitely other variants, including, I want to say it was the Sigma variant, that there was it was felt to have potential to evade the vaccine. There was another variant, and you'll have to excuse me, I don't remember its name, that one of the monoclonal antibodies, I want to say the Lilly product, was less effective against, and for a short time we stopped using the Lilly product. But because these variants did not spread themselves as easily as the Delta variant simply became the predominant variant. It crowded them out. And as a result, for example, we were able to go back to using, I believe it was the Lilly monoclonal antibody, because the, I think it was the Sigma variant, didn't respond well, could evade it, but the Delta variant didn't. So even though the Delta variant was more infectious than this variant, even though the Delta variant couldn't evade the monoclonal antibodies or the vaccine because it was more infectious than the Sigma variant was unable to reproduce itself. And the same thing is going to happen with Omicron. I think the difference between some of these other variants and Omicron is that there is more concern about Omicron because the Delta variant has one, two, or three mutations in its spike proteins. The Omicron variant has many more. So there's concern that it may be more infectious. There's concern because it's already clearly spreading. But right now, it's still a concern. In the next 1 to 2 weeks, we'll know whether or not it is able to evade the antibodies in the vaccine, and we'll probably get a good idea about how contagious it is. And in my mind, what is going to determine whether or not we see it is whether it is more contagious than Delta and whether it can outcompete Delta. Mm.
So during those 1 or 2 weeks that you spoke of, Dr. Goldman, what should we be doing? I mean, there's 1 or 2 weeks where we're waiting to find out just how transmissible the Omicron is. I mean, what should the population be doing during that 1 or 2 weeks of uncertainty?
You know, it's in my mind, it's actually fairly simple. If you're not vaccinated, get vaccinated. If you are vaccinated, get boosted. So when we look, we're actually seeing a marked increase in hospitalizations in our area. We are seeing levels of hospitalizations that are probably the equivalent of last winter, and they're going up fairly rapidly. However, when we look at the people who are hospitalized, 10 to 15% are vaccinated. Usually the people who are hospitalized and vaccinated are much older, above the age of 80. And typically, even if they're above the age of 80 and otherwise medically ill, or they are immune suppressed, so they are both at risk of becoming more sick, and they are at both, and they are at risk of higher and risk of vaccine failure. If we had everyone in our area vaccinated, we wouldn't be seeing a surge of cases right now. And in fact, the typical patient last winter was an elderly patient above the age of 65, 75, often from a nursing home, often very medically sick. And now the typical patient is a 40 to 65-year-old unvaccinated young person who considered themselves healthy. Often they actually don't have a lot of other medical problems with the exception of being heavier, being obese. And in fact, we've changed the epidemiology of the disease. We've taken it from a disease that primarily affects older people above the age of 65. And now, since most older people are vaccinated, the vast majority of people in our hospitals, the vast majority of people in our intensive care units are unvaccinated, young, healthy people. I believe if you are unvaccinated between the ages of 50 and 64, you actually right now have a higher chance of dying than a vaccinated 80-plus-year-old. So this isn't rocket science. you are at higher risk of the disease if you're unvaccinated. Your risk of getting the disease, I think the CDC updated these numbers yesterday, is 5.8 times higher than if you than if you're unvaccinated. And I believe it's about 15 times higher. Your risk of dying is about 15 times higher if you're unvaccinated. So the first, and now if you're vaccinated, I think it's a good idea to get a booster because there is probably after about 6 months, particularly in people above the age of 65, there is a increased risk of breakthrough infections. Above the age of 65, there's a little bit of loss in the protection against severe disease, hospitalization, and death. And so I think getting high levels of antibody into your system when the Delta variant is circulating, which is more infectious, and the Omicron variant, which may be circulating, will make it less likely you get the disease. And in fact, even variants that in the past seem to have evaded the vaccine, most of the breakthrough infections were mild infections, and the vaccines usually still have nearly 100% protection against severe hospitalization and death in otherwise healthy people. So I would say, if you're worried, get a vaccine.
Let's take a phone call from John in Lebanon County. John, you're on Smart Talk.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
My question is, why is it that one variant prevents a person from getting affected by another variant? How do they exclude each other? Why don't people get both variants?
So in other words, why does one cancel the other out?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Goldman?
So for two reasons. One, if the variant just simply outcompetes the other variants, you don't get exposed to the variant which is outcompeted. So for example, the Alpha variant basically disappeared from the United States, and there's very little chance that you will get exposed to it. The second question is, if you have one variant, can you get another infection with the second variant? And the idea is that most of the variants have cross immunity, meaning if you're exposed to the Alpha variant, you have at least partial immunity to the Delta variant. So you are much less likely to get sick. And most importantly, you're much, much less likely to get severe disease. So it's when your body's immune system has been exposed to one of the variants of the coronavirus, it gives you immunity, which at least partially covers the other variants. So you're less likely to get the variant. And if you have a breakthrough infection, you are less likely to get severely ill.
So let me just take that one step further, and we'll use the exact variants. Say someone had the Delta variant. They were exposed. They got sick. They recovered. The Omicron coming along now, are you saying that even if there is a breakthrough case that they were to be exposed to Omicron, the chances are they would not get as sick, not be hospitalized, not die?
I believe that to be true. We don't have enough good, hard, solid data yet so that I know that to be true. However, for example, with any other virus, with the flu virus, which changes from year to year, the first time that flu virus comes through, so if you have a new version of the flu and the first that your people's immune system have not seen before, the first time that virus comes through the population, people get very sick. When it changes slightly and comes through the population again, the flu virus changes a little bit from year to year, people don't get nearly as sick. When the H3N2 strain of the flu pandemic of 1968, which was a new flu virus, in 1968, it killed 100,000 Americans. That same strain still circulates today. And typically, when it circulates, because of cross immunity and because of vaccination, it basically causes a typical flu season. So when you have partial immunity to one strain of any virus, you're much less likely to get severely ill. We are currently testing the Omicron variant to confirm that to be true, but I expect the Omicron variant to act like every other version, every other, the immunity to the Omicron variant to act like every other immunity to every other virus.
I know I have asked this question almost every time you've been on the program. Either I or a listener has asked this question, Dr. Goldman, but it still is one that many people have. I have heard people say, I contracted COVID. I survived it. I'm better now. I don't need to get a vaccination. Is that the case?
So I believe that you should get the vaccination. But I will freely admit that the data on natural immunity versus vaccination isn't very good. The reasons that I believe it is that if you look at other coronaviruses, for example, the coronavirus that causes the common cold, immunity fades out with time. If you look, and there is some data that your antibody levels decline more quickly with natural infection than a full dose of the vaccine. With that said, I haven't seen a lot of people, I have not seen people who have previously had a natural infection in the hospital with severe disease. By the same token, this virus appeared on this earth less than 2 years ago. And so we don't know how long-term immunity looks. But over what I would describe as an overabundance of caution, always recommend that someone who has been previously infected get the vaccine, because I'm convinced that the vaccine is extremely safe, and I'm not convinced that the protection from natural infection will last forever, and I believe that it is better that the risks, the benefits of getting a vaccine, even after natural infection, far, far outweigh the risks.
Let's take another phone call from Lenny in York. Lenny, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to know, how soon could an updated vaccine / booster be manufactured for Omicron if necessary?
So I'm not a virologist, and I'm certainly not a vaccine manufacturer. Both Moderna and Pfizer have worked on boosters that specifically target the Delta virus and have specifically targeted Omicron. My guess is, and this is a guess, 3 to 6 months.
Let's hope that, in fact, I've heard some of those the speculation, and that seems to be pretty consistent. Kit has an email. He says, it just seems to be getting worse, and we seem to be one news cycle away from the next variant. While there is a push to get vaccinated expressed through most news networks, it seems they are using this new variant to suggest being vaccinated will help prevent contracting the new variant, while in the next breath stating it is unsure if the vaccinations currently available will prevent this new COVID virus. It seems disingenuous to me. What I hear from Kit is something I hear from a lot of people: confusion.
So, and the reason that people are confused is the data isn't quite there yet. So we started off the program saying we weren't sure whether or not the Omicron variant evaded the vaccine. What we are sure of is that with other variants that have been able to evade the vaccine, getting vaccinated provided great protection against severe disease and illness. So, for example, with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, when they originally tested it in South Africa, and it was a different variant at that time, and I frankly don't remember the name of that variant, the efficacy of the vaccine was only 56%. So it was much, I think the overall efficacy in the trial was about 74%. So it was much lower. And there was even some speculation that it was because the variant at the time in South Africa evaded the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. However, even in that study, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was 100% effective against preventing hospitalizations and death. So we really have to distinguish two things that vaccines do. One, do they prevent any disease? So do they prevent a breakthrough infection? And in fact, what we've seen is the majority of breakthrough infections are mild. I've had a number of people who were vaccinated who thought that they had minor allergies, possibly a cold, et cetera. The other thing that the vaccines do, and the vaccines do very well, is they protect against severe disease, hospitalizations, and death. So even if you have a breakthrough infection, you're much less likely to get severely ill. And the thought is that even if Omicron is able to evade the vaccine, that the vaccine will still provide substantial protection against severe disease, hospitalization, and death. And in fact, I'm sure you've seen on social media that the COVID is really just the flu. 199 out of 200 people survive it, which is absolutely true. On the other hand, we've had about 750,000 deaths, which is the typical flu season kills 20, 30,000 people. But what will actually turn this into the flu is immunity and vaccination. If everyone in central PA was vaccinated, we would not see the current surge of COVID patients in the hospital. We, in fact, would have the number of COVID patients in the hospital would be the equivalent to a mild flu season. So part of what we want to do is, I personally don't think this is going away. I don't personally think we're going to get to herd immunity because of the difficulty in getting a good percentage of the population vaccinated. What I do hope to happen is that so many people have partial immunity from vaccination or natural infection that this is turned into an equivalent of the flu, which is much less deadly and does not strain our medical system.
Will we be getting annual vaccinations against COVID-19?
One of my favorite expressions is I left my crystal ball at home today.
You've used that before, you know?
I've used that. I use that a lot. My personal opinion is we will get some kind of regular booster. I don't know if it would be annually. I think annually is probably every 3 to 5 years is my best guess. Again, the reason for that is the immunity to natural infection, anti-vaccination seems to wane with time. We now know that we started giving the vaccines less than a year ago, so we don't know if they last a full year because no one has been vaccinated for a full year. And then the vaccine has shown that it has the ability to mutate rapidly. And so I kind of believe that what will happen is there will be a gradual decline in your immunity, either from natural infection or vaccination. The virus will change enough that it will have some ability to make the vaccine less effective and to provide less protection against the virus. And as a result, we will need some kind of a booster on some kind of regular basis. My gut is that it won't be every year. It'll be every 3 to 5 years, but that's just a gut feeling. That's not based on any real evidence.
Why do you say that though, when we get an annual flu shot, a vaccine against the flu?
So the flu virus, I think, mutates a little bit more rapidly. There are more strains of the flu going around, and the spike in the immunity so far to the spike, the new variants, has held up. The vaccines that are targeted towards the original strain of COVID, the immunity, they still work against most of the new variants that have come up. My gut is that this virus, although it mutates quickly, the mutations and the immunity to the spike proteins will probably decline more slowly. Again, that's just a gut feeling.
Let's take some questions from listeners. Katie asks, my husband and I are scheduled for our booster shots next week. We plan to go see the new Spider-Man movie a week after that. How quickly does the booster protect us? Is it right away or does it take 2 weeks like the first shots? We're nervous about sitting in a crowded theater.
So a couple things. First of all, it's a great question. And you assume that it's a little bit faster because you have pre-existing immunity and your immune response, you're likely to have what's called an amnestic response, which means that your body has been primed to recognize the virus and responds more quickly. But I don't know that there's good data. I would feel comfortable going to a movie theater a week after the booster, although I would advise you anytime you go to a movie theater, wear a mask, even if you're vaccinated.
And along those lines, I know that there are a lot of people wondering about holiday gatherings. The holiday parties have already started. As we get closer to Christmas, there will be more people getting together. What kind of advice do you have for people who are, you know, let's face it, most of them will be indoors?
So I would advise, first of all, that if you're going to have an indoor gathering, everyone should be vaccinated. Secondly, I think you then have to look at the risk of the people there. Third, you have to see how much disease there is in our area. So if everyone is gathering and is vaccinated and they are healthy, they're under the age of 50, I think it's very safe. The harder part is, what do you do when you have elderly parents, elderly grandparents? And I think, first of all, if you have elderly parents or elderly grandparents and disease activity is high, if you aren't vaccinated, you shouldn't come to Christmas. If you aren't vaccinated, you shouldn't come to Thanksgiving, because even if the elderly parents or grandparents are vaccinated, a breakthrough infection has a higher risk of causing severe disease. The second thing would be, if there is very little disease in the area, then I think a gathering is safe. If they're in the middle of what we saw last winter, where there was a lot of disease, then you have to be more cautious. And you particularly have to be more cautious if someone is in attendance who is older and more at risk of a vaccine failure and more at risk of severe disease. Basically, you have to tailor. I think there's some general rules. One, no one who's unvaccinated should be at your holiday party. If you have elderly parents, elderly grandparents who are going to be at the holiday party, it's best to have everyone who is coming boosted. And if there is a lot of disease in your area and there is an elderly parent or grandparent, maybe a good idea to have a small not a large gathering.
My daughter, this comes from Joyce. She says, my daughter had a breakthrough case of COVID in mid-September. She has lingering symptoms such as loss of smell, lingering fatigue, brain fog at times. Should she get her third shot, the booster, or wait until the side effects disappear?
That is an extremely good question without an extremely good answer. Note that she's having what sounds like long COVID symptoms. Including the sense of the slow resolution, loss of the sense of taste, smell. People describe brain fog, and no one quite understands what those are from. I would personally get a booster because I don't think it is going to be to affect the course of long COVID. And I would also send her to one of the long COVID clinics in the area. UPMC has a long COVID clinic run by one of our pulmonologists. And I would get her checked out both to make sure that there wasn't something that happened during the course of her illness that we missed, and to kind of figure out whether this is difficulties breathing, it's just being tired. Many people are tired and have brain fog after any viral illness, and whether this is a post-viral fatigue. But I would personally still recommend the COVID shot. I can't tell you that I have good data on the effect of COVID boosters in long-haul COVID patients.
That long-haul COVID, I mean, the whole thing is frightening to begin with. I mean, it's a disease that you can die from. But that long-haul COVID is especially frightening because, as you just answered, there's so much we don't know about it, and whether this is a permanent situation for many people, whether these symptoms are permanent, whether they'll just disappear one day, how to treat it. I mean, as a medical professional, how do you look at long haul? I mean, is it still one of those things that we just don't know enough about?
So the first thing I would do as a medical professional is admit that it is likely to have multiple causes, and the disease is too new to have anywhere near as good an understanding as I would like to have. So I believe the first thing to do is to make sure that there isn't something that happened during the course of the illness. For example, a stroke that was missed, a blood clot that was missed, that there isn't residual damage to the lungs that is causing some of these symptoms. And then also evaluate for what's known as post-viral fatigue. There are a lot of people who stay very tired and report brain fog after any viral illness. And my experience in treating, and it's an infectious disease, you treat a lot of patients like this, is that it kind of gradually resolves. Typically send people to physical therapy. I often give a trial of a drug called amitriptyline, which often the patients have disrupted sleep. It helps them sleep. It helps some of the muscle aches and pain. But as a general rule, it tends to resolve. Once residual effects of COVID are ruled out, I generally encourage people to remain active and to, within a reasonable amount, exercise and so forth. Because what I have seen is that when people get tired and fatigued, they stop moving, sometimes gain weight. That sometimes causes them to stop moving more. And so, as you can tell, it's kind of a multifactorial approach. You rule out other diseases. You rule out damage from COVID. You make sure there's no damage to the lungs. And you there's some medications you can try, but then you also begin trying to get people to stay active and not let the fatigue start causing new problems.
Dr. Goldman, Marsha writes, recently my husband had to undergo a treatment of prednisone, which he was taking orally. We were told not to get any vaccines during that time because the drug is an immune suppressant. He's now past that period. We're getting ready to schedule our booster shot. We're both fully vaccinated at 67 years old. A couple of days ago, I received a cortisone injection directly into the bursa of my hip for bursitis. As this is a steroid, I'm guessing it's also an immune suppressant. Do I need to wait a period of time to get my booster, or is this more a localized injection that doesn't spread as much throughout the bloodstream?
My understanding is that a bursal injection does not spread throughout the bloodstream, and I would not delay the booster on the basis of that. If there are steroids, that's absorbed into your system, it's at a very low level.
Jeff asks, he says, I've had COVID once, possibly twice, had both Pfizer vaccines. Is a booster needed?
I, again, personally would get a booster. It depends a little bit on it. I think that especially if you tolerated the two previous vaccines, you're unlikely to have a side effect from the vaccine. You are likely to have more immunity than most if you have both had natural infection and vaccination. I still would recommend the booster. Again, it's a bit of a judgment call.
You know, I'm curious. We've mentioned flu a couple of times. Last year's flu season, we had very few cases compared to previous years. What have you seen so far this year?
So far this year, we've seen some flu. If you look nationally, last year at the peak of our flu season, we saw less flu than you typically see in August or July or August. This year, we're seeing low levels early on that would be consistent with a more typical flu season. If I were going to guess, I would say that because of the relaxing and social distancing and masking, we will see a mild flu season this year. It won't be as bad as a typical flu season because we still have some because we still have some social distancing and some masking.
A question that I'm sure has arisen many times for you: how to know the difference between flu, cold, COVID?
The short message is, in most cases, you can't. They present in often many of the same ways. COVID has a little bit more of a tendency to cause severe disease, especially in young people. 90% of the people who die of the flu are above the age of 65. 76% of COVID patients are above the age of 65. So instead of 10% of people dying under the age of 65, it's about 24%. The only symptom that tells you you almost certainly have COVID is the loss of the sense of smell or taste. There are very few other diseases that do that. And if you have what you think is a cold and you suddenly can't taste or smell anything, you almost certainly have COVID. But otherwise, it is really indistinguishable from the flu or any other viral infection.
That loss of taste and smell, I mean, is that very noticeable? As someone who has never experienced that sensation, is that something you know right away?
People have described to me that they notice they can't taste anything. They have had people describe to me trying to make sure they, you know, eating something that's normally really spicy and they can't stand and they just can't taste it. So people do notice it.
Let's take a phone call from Leslie, who is on I-81, I understand. Leslie, you're on the air.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, my question is about hospitalization costs. I subscribe to the Johns Hopkins report, and I read that hospitalization for COVID costs about $20,000. And who's paying for that? Are all these unvaccinated people having their $20,000 costs paid for by all the rest of us that are vaccinated and are not incurring this cost as taxpayers? I mean, I don't understand.
I don't know whether that's something that Dr. Goldman can answer, but the point that she's making is that those who are unvaccinated have some responsibility.
So one of the things that I always stress is that no matter what I feel or what we feel about whether or not you should or shouldn't be vaccinated, if you come through our doors, we will treat you as well as we can and as compassionately as we can. One of the things about medicine is we have the job of protecting you from the consequences of your often bad decisions. And we have done that before COVID. We have done, and we're doing that after COVID. in my mind, COVID is no different than many of the patients I've treated who I personally think have made a bad decision, have drank too much, have done drugs they shouldn't do, have made lifestyle choices that might have gotten them to their illness. It's my job to protect them from that. And it's my job to try to prevent any more damage from happening to them. And COVID is no different. And so even if people have made a choice to take a risk, and even if that choice seems like it was wrong, they get severely ill, I don't view it as my job to pass judgment on them. I view it as my job to try to treat them.
We have a call from Daphne, or an email, I should say. She had both Pfizer vaccines in March. She says, I will not take the booster until the people of poor countries have a chance to get their first vaccine. Thanksgiving family gathered, all tested before gathering, Monday after. One child who had recently been vaccinated from out of state came down with a fever, testing positive. A vaccinated adult from another state has now tested positive. So she's talking about two different things there. And this is a big picture issue, but the point that she's making out of principle is that she won't get the booster until those poor countries do have enough vaccines. Is that a right decision, one that she's making out of principle?
This is a moral judgment, and I personally do not believe so. And part of the reason that I do not believe so is your deciding to forego a vaccination in the United States does not free up a vaccine to, for example, send to South Africa. So remember, I work in central Pennsylvania. I view it as my job to take care of the people of central Pennsylvania. And I feel like that is the best, a booster is the best way to protect them. I also don't believe that if we in central Pennsylvania decided that none of us were going to take boosters, that would suddenly open up vaccine supply for the rest of the world. In fact, with the vaccine surplus in the United States, it might mean that some vaccines are just simply thrown out. The second thing is, I would argue that the story you just told is indicative of limitations of testing. You can be negative on Friday, and if you get ill on Monday, you test positive. The test doesn't tell you that at that point in time you are not infectious. It doesn't tell you that you don't have the disease. It doesn't tell you that you aren't going to get the disease the next day or the next. The second thing would be, and I hope that everyone in your at the Thanksgiving dinner, in fact, has mild disease. If that's true, I would then argue that the vaccines did their job. They didn't prevent any infection, but they may have prevented you from becoming severely ill. The chances that you become severely ill, even if exposed, are clearly less with the vaccine.
Along the same lines, Mike asked, he said, I recently learned of a young, healthy individual who was vaccinated with Pfizer in May, came down with COVID in September, and is currently experiencing cold symptoms, including loss of smell again. Recent COVID test was negative. In listening to today's conversation, it sounds like the individual has COVID again. How rare is that? How rare is that?
We have not seen a lot of cases of reinfection with COVID. Now, part of that may be that it is mild disease, and so many people may not get tested. So I would say that if he lost his sense of smell again, he does in fact have COVID. I would probably repeat the test in 3 to 5 days. And again, it is a little unusual.
Cheryl asks, says, no one has addressed the residual effects of remdesivir. I had COVID in March and April and received 5 days of this drug. I believe what I thought was long COVID may be the effects of this drug.
I have not seen reports of long-term effects of remdesivir. It's known that it can affect liver function when you're given remdesivir. Those are monitored on a daily basis. But I have not seen any descriptions of long remdesivir side effects.
Hmm. Here's Steve from Mechanicsburg asked. He said that he got 3 jabs of Pfizer and had 0 reaction. He's wondering if he got a bad dose because he didn't have a reaction.
People really wonder about that. I think there is no good data on the correlation between side effects and whether or not you develop an immune response. I would argue to him he is more likely to have had some good luck, meaning no side effects, than bad luck, meaning not an effect of the vaccine.
Yeah, I got my booster last week, and at the same time, I got a pneumonia shot. And in the arm I got in the pneumonia shot, I felt bad. You know, the arm hurt and all that. So I've had no reaction whatsoever from vaccines. Allison asking, Allison, I'm not going to be able to get to your phone call, but I'll ask your question. She says in August 2019, she had a respiratory infection. That infection cost her taste and smell for a few days. Are there any other non-fatal COVID-related viruses that where you lose your sense of smell and taste?
I have not heard of other viruses that do that. There's a lot of speculation that COVID was around for longer than we knew. And it is possible that she had an early case.
Hmm. Dr. Goldman, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you very much. In this last 45 seconds, we have advice going into the holiday season.
Get vaccinated, get boosted.
Get vaccinated, get boosted. Dr. John Goldman, infectious disease specialist at UPMC here in Central Pennsylvania. Always a pleasure talking with you, Dr. Goldman. Happy holidays, and we'll be talking again soon, I'm sure.
Happy holidays to you, too. Thank you.